So welcome everyone to the July 20th edition of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace teleconference series, where every month we're interviewing, having conversations with leaders, thought leaders, and leaders from the worlds of business, academia, and the faith traditions, asking questions about what can the faith and spiritual traditions teach those of us in the business world that can make us more effective as we serve all stakeholders. This is, as I mentioned, the July edition. This is a monthly teleconference series. And this month, we are beginning to talk to some folks who will be part of the conference that's coming up November 7th through 9th. This is the International Conference for Faith and Spirit at Work that will be held November 7th through 9th at the University of Arkansas. And this month, we're very pleased to have Cindy Wigglesworth as our guest. I'll tell you more about Cindy in a moment, but in the meantime, welcome, Cindy. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
We're going to start, as we always do, these conference calls with just a short reading, followed by a few minutes of time in the silence where I just invite you to turn to source, as you define source, allows us to kind of touch in with our own sense of source and with one another as we begin our time today. And this is a special reading today because it is from as yet unpublished book that Cindy is in the process of writing. I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the call today. But the book's working title is The 21 Skills of Spiritual Intelligence, A Roadmap for Personal and Professional Growth. And this is from Chapter 1, titled Becoming Fully Human. We are drawn toward our own higher potential. We are seeking something. Yet we usually cannot describe the discontent we feel or how we would go about reaching the place we are trying to get to. Even the experts, the mystics, teachers, saints, and sages from the great wisdom traditions, don't seem to agree when it comes down to the nuts and bolts of spiritual transformation. As Maslow points out, there are numerous names for this ultimate goal: self-actualization, self-transcendence, spiritual realization or awakening, individuation, and many more. And for every name, there are even more paths to get there. Each tradition has its own paths, creeds, and esoteric mysteries. And some seem convinced that the way they describe is the only true one. This tendency to be exclusive and to make other paths wrong has troubled me for most of my life. It just does not seem logical to me. If there is truly a single ultimate goal for human development, should it not be possible to describe a faith-neutral and objective way to reach that goal? And shouldn't we be able, using tools pioneered by psychology and other sciences, to more objectively agree upon standards by which progress in human development can be measured? Wouldn't such an approach allow each path to continue to teach its adherents how to grow, yet show that many other paths can work too? And with those big questions, I just invite you to take a moment in silence. Thank you. So as I've said, our guest today is Cindy Wigglesworth. And Cindy is a graduate with both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree from Duke University. And she has 20 years of experience in human resources management with ExxonMobil. She founded her business, now called Deep Change, in 2000. Cindy is certified in emotional intelligence and has created, validated, and researched the first skills-based spiritual intelligence assessment instrument for business and personal use. And it's this assessment that will be the main topic of our conversation today. This instrument is both faith-neutral and faith-friendly, and it allows business people to talk about spiritual intelligence skills and how to develop them without using the language of religion, while still making the connection to beliefs and practices that are of deep personal importance for each person. Cindy is on the working council of the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace. She served on the board of the International Center for Spirit at Work, and she was chair of the 2003 and 2004 International Spirit at Work Awards Selection Committee. She's a professional speaker and a trainer. And, as I was looking through her resume and her background, I would say that all of these things pale in comparison to the one badge of achievement that stands out above all others on her resume, and it's this. Cindy has appeared on Oprah. So, welcome, Cindy. Good day.
You are so funny.
Well, I have to tell you.
I know, now that Oprah's off the air, it is really like something to say.
Well, it's limited edition things that are now, they're not making any more of those like they were, so that makes it even more valuable.
Right.
So, Cindy, I first welcome. It's very good to have you here today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here, Tom.
So, I know a little bit about your background. We have met and talked, and I've listened in as you have conducted other interviews like this, and I know that early in your career you were very successful. You were highly educated, highly intelligent young woman starting a fresh path and fresh career at ExxonMobil. I'm sure you were progressing nicely and your career was going along very well. But something happened, and talk for a moment, if you would, about what it was that set you from being a rising HR professional at ExxonMobil to now having developed this idea of spiritual intelligence. What started you down this path?
Yes, well, as I look back, I would be able to describe it now in ways I couldn't have really articulated it so well then. But now that I understand the field of multiple intelligences, when I started at work, it was the initial feedback from my supervisors was around, you're really bright and you're really hardworking and you're kind of annoying and you might want to work on your interpersonal skills. They weren't quite that blunt, they were more gentle about it. But, the truth of it was, and I can sort of visualize some of those meetings in my mind and how I was behaving. And, the arrogance of youth is so embarrassing when you get a little older and you look back and you go, I can't believe I was talking to people with 20 years of experience the way I was talking to them. And this sort of know-it-all attitude that you often have, people often have when they get out of college, which, in hindsight, I would now say what I was lacking was emotional intelligence. And what the researchers have shown us now is that that's actually pretty common for people in their 20s because the brain is not fully formed until about age 22 to 25. And when that prefrontal cortex comes fully on stream, right about age 22 to 25, is when we really become capable of properly monitoring and regulating our emotional state so that we can have emotional intelligence. But the bottom line was, as I was getting feedback on my interpersonal skills, and so I had to set about working on that. The emotional intelligence material had not been published at that time, so it was pretty much up to me. Between some effective supervision classes I was able to go to and therapy that I was participating in outside of work to develop some emotional self-awareness, some empathy with others, and some appropriate understanding of how I was appearing to other people so that I could modify my behaviors. And as I did that, it had very positive results. So it quickly became a positive self-reinforcing feedback loop where if I could learn to behave better in meetings and be a little less arrogant and pushy, that actually I got more of what I wanted. I got to feel included in the team did better, and my performance numbers improved. Then sort of the next step in my journey, sort of in completely outside of business, I found a new church, which was Unity, and I started practicing very applied Christianity, which was, to me, my faith tradition is Christian, and I had left the church I was raised in, but hadn't found a new church home for several years, and when I did, I was really happy to find one that was focused on practical applications of love, because loving thy neighbor was always the sticky point for me, whether it was being arrogant in a business meeting or whether it was really deeply seeing other people as, divine beings and having compassion, having forgiveness. So, the practical how do you love your neighbor stuff had bothered me for a long time. And so as I started practicing and going to workshops, I kind of went through a workshop junkie period where I was going to everything and reading everything. And I started developing skills. And I noticed all of a sudden, aha moment occurred at work where it's like, this is really making a difference in my leadership skills. And when I saw what a difference it was making in my leadership skills, I thought, you know, how could I talk about this in a work setting? I work in human resources. One of the things we do is executive development. We worry about leadership capacity building. And yet I can't talk about this because it's got this huge, you know, the S word, the spirituality word, and all tangled up with religion and diversity concerns. So it started me thinking about, this is incredibly not logical that these skills are relevant and we can't teach them. So there's got to be a way to do this. Shortly after I started pondering that question, Daniel Goleman and Richard Boyatzis started publishing their work on emotional intelligence, and I figured that, quote-unquote, somebody had to be out there doing similar work around spirituality. And after much searching, I came to realize that nobody was really creating a parallel set of constructs around skills that would be faith-neutral, faith-friendly, but, you know, totally acceptable in a workplace. And sort of long story short, after many years of reflecting, this wasn't a decision I made quickly, but between when I knew this was my next career and when I left Exxon, which became then ExxonMobil, was a 5-year period. So I was very successfully working my way up the corporate ladder, but in parallel, I was also noticing that there was something important that I felt called to do. And after I had the financial stability to do so, I left ExxonMobil and started this business.
Mm-hmm. So how did you begin to develop this model that we're now calling the spiritual intelligence assessment tool? And I'm also curious about what some of your potentially earlier influences were as you were starting to gather data and look at this more deeply.
Right. So the single biggest influence was the emotional intelligence work of Daniel Goleman and Richard Boyatzis, the model that they had come up with of 4 quadrants. So as I sat with that 4-quadrant model of emotional intelligence, and it's not the same as the integral 4 quadrants, for those who know that one, it had in the upper left of the emotional intelligence 4 quadrants was emotional self-awareness, and then upper right, social awareness, lower left, emotional self-management, and lower right, good social skills or good relationship skills. And I thought, there's something really intuitively strong about this, that I feel like spiritual intelligence would be a vertical step up in complexity. Like, you'd have to have some emotional intelligence before you could really move into the spiritually intelligent domain. But I think if we could describe this thing as skills, that it would have a parallel 4 quadrants. We would be able to populate the 4 quadrants with a list of skills, just like they had done for emotional intelligence. And we would be able to describe every skill from novice to expert. And if I can't do that, if I can't break it down and describe each skill from novice to practitioner to expert, then I'm really not dealing with skills. I'm dealing with something else. So the first test was, could I do that? Now, when I was trying to figure out, okay, what do you stick in these quadrants? You know, I kind of put labels on the 4 quadrants for spiritual intelligence, and I started thinking about what would go in them. I was holding in my mind a couple of things. I was holding in my mind all the spiritual exemplars that we tend to look up to. When you say, who do you admire as a spiritual leader? The same kinds of names tend to come up. You know, Jesus, the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, Muhammad, Buddha, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, people like that. And so I would hold in my mind and sort of run through the different world religions. You know, like if it was Lao Tzu, what would Lao Tzu from Taoism, you know, what would his characteristics be that would fit in these 4 quadrants? If it was Buddha, if it was Jesus. So I was trying to be very faith balanced when I created these skills. I was also holding in mind the stages of faith work that Fowler had done, which had very much impressed me as, you know, sort of the developmental journey of faith. And it looked to me like he was describing a novice to expert journey. So I would say those were the primary influences when I was structuring all of this.
And one of the things I've heard you talk about as you've distinguished this work and this assessment is the difference between being spiritual and having a level or an assessment level of spiritual intelligence. Talk about that a little bit, just so we get a real clear distinction here.
Thank you. That's a really important distinction, because one of the objections I sometimes hear is, well, people are spiritual or they're not, or we're all spiritual, you can't measure that. And I think it's a fair question, you know, like, what part of this is not measurable, and don't deceive ourselves about that. You know, I can't put God in a box, and I'm not going to say that one person is spiritual and another person is not. So the distinction that I make is that we are all born spiritual, but we are not born spiritually intelligent. And the difference is that being spiritual is an innate part of who we are. Being spiritually intelligent is a set of skills that we have to develop. And if you think about emotional intelligence as a parallel, we are all born, assuming we have no brain damage, with the capacity to feel fear and anger and other emotions, joy and love. And those emotions, while we have the capacity for emotions, do not automatically translate into being emotionally intelligent, because the measure of emotional intelligence is the outcome is good interpersonal skills. So everyone's spiritual, not everyone is spiritually intelligent. Being spiritually intelligent is a set of skills that we can learn over time. And that was the hypothesis I entered this development process for the SQI, believing that I'd have to be able to describe these skills from novice to expert, and we'd have to be able to go through a process of validating this assessment in order for me to believe I had a construct that was workable. And, of course, as you know, we have been through quite a bit of validation with this assessment.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned when you were talking about emotional intelligence that these are skill sets that really start showing up potentially in our 20s. As we reach certain developmental stages, have you found a correlation on spiritual intelligence levels with age? That's kind of part one of my question. And the second piece of that I'd like you to speak into a little bit. Does one have to come before the other, have you observed kind of tandem developments in both areas? How does that work from your research?
Right. So the first question, have we noticed correlation with age? Yes, when we did the beta pilot on this assessment, we had over 500 people participate in taking the SQI, and they provided certain demographics to us so that we could look for various correlations. And the most important one I was looking for was age, because if in fact you have a set of skills, you should see a positive correlation to age. Now, that doesn't mean that just because you get to be 60 or 70 or 80 years old that you're going to have high scores. But if you were to see no correlation to age, or an inverse correlation, like people were better at it when they were younger than when they were older, then you'd say, well, this is something else. This is like athletic ability. You have it when you're 20 and you lose it by the time you're 60 or something. But we did see a strong correlation to age. So what this tells me is we can learn it over time, and it's not something that you can just pop out of the womb knowing how to do. It's a set of skills. Mm-hmm. So that was a confirmation of the hypothesis that this was, in fact, a set of skills. Now, the relationship to emotional intelligence, we have not done any research yet to say we've cross-correlated the Daniel Goleman assessment with the SQI, and that would be something great for a PhD student who might want to take that on. But what I can tell you from observation of myself and the people I've now trained to coach to the SQI is that the sort of logic of looking at these skills tells you that empathy, which is a emotional intelligence skill, would precede compassion, which is a spiritual intelligence skill. And that just kind of intuitively makes sense. And experientially, those of the coaches that I work with who are certified in emotional intelligence, either by Goleman or other people, and work with the SQI, experience that is in fact true, that if someone is not yet demonstrating the basics of emotional intelligence, that seems to be where the intervention needs to take place first, rather than jumping straight to spiritual intelligence, because the EQ work builds a foundation upon which we can build the SQ work.
So I want to push in with you a little bit into kind of on-the-ground practical application, and have you talk a little bit about where you've seen some success in these approaches. But before I do, I want to just mention to everyone listening that we're going to move into a period of question and answers here in a moment. I'm going to open the phone line and allow others to have a chance to talk to Cindy. If you have a question or something you'd like to talk to Cindy about on this subject, you can hit *5 on your phone, and I will. I have a computer screen in front of me, and it'll indicate a little hand raise and let me know that you've got a question, and I can unmute you, and you can join in the conversation. So as everyone is thinking about what they'd like to talk to you about or questions they'd like to ask you, share with us some of your actual kind of work in the field with these ideas.
Sure, and I realize that we kind of jumped into this without defining spiritual intelligence, so I guess I should give you the quick definition of what it is.
Oh, yeah, please
and then
do that.
Because you and I, we've talked before, so we kind of know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So spiritual intelligence, as I define it, is the ability to behave with wisdom and compassion while maintaining inner and outer peace regardless of the situation. And the reason for these words, I'll kind of tease it apart. Wisdom and compassion are a very important piece to me because initially I was going to say it's the ability to behave with love. But love in the English language is a very sloppy word. It's very vague. We say, I love my children and I love pizza, and we use the same word. So it's insufficiently clear, right? So I was looking for what would be a better way of getting at that construct because so many of the world religions and philosophies talk about loving your neighbor. But like, how do we get to that? And I found this parable from the East that says love is a bird with two wings. One wing is compassion. The other wing is wisdom. If either wing is broken, the bird cannot fly. And when I found it, I got goosebumps from head to toe. It was one of those, oh, thank you, God, there it is. That's what I've been looking for. Because compassion to me represents the most elevated state of what we would call our heart. And wisdom, the most elevated state of the mind. And it's about bringing those two together to act with love. So behaving with love, wisdom and compassion, while maintaining inner and outer peace, regardless of the situation. So the inner and outer peace has to do with the fact that so many of us have mastered, and that's part of the emotional intelligence, is like not having angry outbursts of people. We can manage to control ourselves, but we're still feeling the upset on the inside. That upset on the inside becomes exhausting and leads to burnout. And I've found that in healthcare in particular, like nurses and doctors have to deal, and chaplains, of course, with very difficult situations with patients and family members. They will often, at great personal expense, maintain this exterior of calm. Well, where SQ kind of takes the step forward is to say, let's get rid of the trigger of anger. We're going to completely reframe and see the situation differently. See through the eyes of love, see through the eyes of the other, and from that enhanced perspective, there's no need to be angry. So we just get rid of it, and then we're able to be calm. That in any situation, little thing that tags on at the end, you know, able to do this in any circumstances, any situation, is a saintly level of attainment, not one that I have yet accomplished. But it sets the direction for me, you know, so I want to behave with love, I want to not get unnecessarily triggered into anger because I have the capacity for forgiveness and compassion, mm-hmm. and to be able to do that as often as possible. Mm-hmm. Now, why would that matter for a workplace? And I've had a couple of wonderful client engagements in healthcare where I have been able to help apply these principles with the support of the management team and see if we could get benefit. One of them was the Methodist Hospital System here in Houston. And this was my first major engagement after I left ExxonMobil. It was a 2-year engagement. They had committed to take the entire system, 6,000 or more employees, and do a culture change where they were really living from their mission, vision, values statement. They had taken 2 years to rewrite those statements. They had a new value statement that spelled I care, which is integrity, compassion, accountability, respect, and excellence. And they wanted to, quote-unquote, implement that. How do we create a culture that does that? Well, and they had a mission of creating a spiritual environment of caring. And the spiritual environment of caring was to be faith-neutral but faith-friendly. The Methodist hospital system is owned by the Methodist Church, but is very clearly diversity-sensitive. So it's like they wanted to be explicitly spiritual, they wanted these values, and they wanted a consultant to help them through that process. So I ended up engaging with them really before I had developed the SQI. So I was in the development process, And in fact, they helped me with some of the development by providing focus groups, but we weren't able to use the assessment because it wasn't finished yet. But we did use the principles of spiritual intelligence in the design of the interventions, and it was a full-blown culture change organizational development activity. So this was not just a training program. But one piece of it was a training program that all 6,000 employees had to attend. It was a half a day that my company designed for them around their core values and around what does it mean to have a spiritual environment of caring. We also had flow through into the performance appraisal process. We had all kinds of measures where we were keeping track. We used Richard Barrett's values assessment to measure where we were as a business, the whole company, on the values before we started any intervention, a year into it, a year later. And they also kept track of all the things to care about, like press gainy scores for patient satisfaction, bed vacancy rates because empty beds in hospitals are expensive, nursing vacancy rates because when there's an empty job and you have to backfill with a contract employee, that's very expensive, and it drives your patient satisfaction numbers down because the substitute contract nurses don't know where things are, don't know processes and procedures very well, so that tends to drive that down. Having a lot of turnover tended to be bad for employee satisfaction as well, and very high cost because every time they signed a new nurse, they were paying a bonus and so on. So we were keeping track of all these different business measures. And at the end of 2 years, they were able to drive their vacant jobs, their contract nursing dollars went to zero. So they were able to keep their jobs filled. Bed rates went up. Patient satisfaction hit an all-time high. So these things are very pragmatic. You know, sometimes there's this feeling that it's a nice thing to do this spiritual intelligence work and this emotional intelligence work, but it's kind of like you got to have extra dollars for it because there's not any benefit. There was real bottom line benefit to this organization, very tangible bottom line benefit. And in addition, because of the iCare program, they got listed for the first time on the Fortune 100 Best Employers list, and they have now worked their way up to the top 10. So huge kudos to the management team, who was like a bulldog fixed on making this a reality, because no consultant can do this unless the management team is completely committed. And the human resources group was fantastic. Their little saying was, we're going to revise every process from recruitment to retirement to make it congruent with this new mission, vision, and values. And because of that, they changed how they hired people. They changed the compensation system, the promotion system, everything. So it was a whole system intervention, but it was really exciting from in terms of a tangible value result. So that's probably the biggest, flashiest case that I have.
Wow. We've got a hand raised. I don't have a name, but the last four digits of the phone number are 6250. I'm going to unmute you. Give it just a second to click through. Okay, so you're on. You have a question? You want to introduce yourself? Hello?
Yes. This is, my name is Steve, and I'm calling from San Diego. And I do have a question for Cindy. Cindy, with respect to practice and development, spiritual intelligence, the development of spiritual intelligence, about a year or so ago, maybe a year and a half, I became aware that growing out of the Integral Institute was something called Integral Enlightenment, and that Craig Hamilton was involved in that, and have been getting emails from that organization over the past several months. And I wanted to know if you're familiar with their work, with their approach, and if so, is what they're doing applicable to an organized method for developing spiritual intelligence?
Okay. I will tell you, I know of Craig's work. I have not experienced Craig's work. So all I can tell you is that I am aware that it exists. I know a lot of people are enthused about it, but I haven't had direct experience, so I can't tell you, you know, based on my experience, here's what I think. Now, within the spiritual assessment, there are 21 skills. And the process of taking the assessment is designed to serve a particular purpose for you and the client. So, Steve, if you were to take it, you'd get a report back. And we suggest to people that you look at this report as sort of guidance from your higher self to you, saying, you know, here are some things you might want to think about working on. what I recommend that people do is treat the spiritual intelligence assessment as sort of the starting point for deciding what to work on. So if you were going to be deciding, do I want to engage with the Integral Enlightenment process of Craig Hamilton, one option would be for you to just sit down with yourself, not using my assessment, and say, what's attracting me here? What do I think I would gain from this? What do I think is the gap in my own development I'm trying to fill? And is this the best tool to use to do it? The assessment's just a more methodical way of accomplishing that. So by examining the 21 skills, answering these questions, you get a reflection back. You know, you might want to consider working on forgiveness, might be one of the things that you would get back. And then you'd say, well, if forgiveness is my highest priority, maybe I want to look at just a more narrow approach to just dealing with that. In which case, there'll be some suggestions, and the coaches that we train also have suggestions. But you could look to your faith tradition of origin. You could look to secular resources like Byron Katie's forgiveness work called The Work, or Colin Tipping's work on radical forgiveness with the Stanford Forgiveness Project from the state of California, your home state. So I can't give you any specifics about Craig, just to say that I know it's out there. I'm a big fan of integral theory, and I'm a big fan of the Enlighten Next work, and I know Craig is influenced by both of those. But I can't give you anything very specific about Craig's work.
Thank you, Steve.
Does that help?
I went ahead. I had to mute, Steve. There was some background noise. But thank you for calling in. Great, great question. So we can look at the assessment as a way, as just that, as an assessment. Where are we strong? Where do we have places that we could work on? And then use it as a guide to turn to the right resources, coaching or our faith tradition sources or whatever else we might have in our bag of tricks, so to speak. We can turn to those other things as a way of developing those areas that we would like to develop in.
Absolutely. So it sort of gives you a way to narrow the field. There's so much material out there, so many workshops, so many books, and we all are busy people. So given the time and energy and money that you have, what would for you right now be the best use of your time and money? It can help you focus in that way.
And this is probably a good opportunity or good place to ask you, how can people find out more about this assessment if they'd like to maybe take it for themselves or get some more information?
Right. They can go to deepchange.com and click on the store. Now, I will tell you that there is a special promotion running right now. The normal cost of the SQI plus an hour debrief by one of my trained coaches, that you'll see the prices on the website, is $499. And, you know, for people who debrief with me, it's usually $599. But we are running a special through Integral Life for $295 for that same package. And so that's a tremendous value, and I'm not sure how many more months we're going to have it available. But to get that deal, email me directly at Cindy, C-I-N-D-Y, at deepchange.com, and I will send people to the link directly where they can get that special deal. It's the SQI itself, and then an hour of coaching by one of my trained coaches who are just phenomenal people. And the feedback we've been getting from the folks who are doing this promotion is just through the roof positive. People are really loving the experience.
When do you expect to have your book available?
I'm hoping by July of next year. The publishing process can take a little while. So I have an agent, and I have now completed the 12 chapters. I've got to do a little more work on appendices and things like that. But my agent and I have been talking about which publishers to approach, because some publishers will take 2 to 3 years to get to market. And I've told him that I just don't feel like I can wait that long. So there are some smaller publishing houses that are much quicker to act. And so we're going to make a decision on a publisher here in probably the next 2 months. And then we will get that thing out there, hopefully, first half of next year.
You know, a question that occurred to me as I was preparing for this call that I wanted to ask you about. Yeah, you've talked about effectiveness in organizational management and a lot of the ways that you've measured how the Methodist Hospital case study is an example. Have you done any work? Is there any correlation that you're aware of between higher levels of spiritual intelligence and creativity or problem solving or kind of, you know, those sorts of outcomes?
I will tell you the closest piece of research we have to that, and you know, as you know, but the listeners may not know, I have completely self-funded the research to this point. So the creation of the assessment, the validation of the assessment, and the research we've done so far has all been out of my pocket, and it's been quite expensive endeavor. So I'm really enthusiastic about anybody who wants to do research, and I could provide the SQI for that purpose. But a piece of research that we did do with Suzanne Cook-Reuter's help is we used a measure that she runs on adult development. It's a Harvard-based instrument. It's very well respected, and it measures stage of development. And stage of adult development includes, among many things, the broadness of your thinking. How many systems, how many perspectives can you hold simultaneously is one of the key criteria of showing vertical movement on her model. And as you can hold more perspectives, you get more, quote-unquote, out-of-the-box thinking. In other words, more creative solutions that are likely to actually work because you're able to hold all of this complexity. My hypothesis was that what I was seeing in the SQ work should be very positively correlated. In other words, if you scored well on the SQI, you should also score higher on stages of adult development. In my hypothesis, which we will test longer term, is that in fact you can't get to these higher stages of adult development without developing emotional and spiritual intelligence. Okay. So we tested that by having 139 people, and what we were looking for in this step one is a correlation. So is there a correlation between the higher stages of adult development as tested by Suzanne Cook-Reuter's model and higher SQI scores? And with this 139 people, they spanned, I think, about 8 stages of adult development, so it's a pretty good spectrum. And we got a very strong positive correlation to the point where my statistician said it's a 1% chance that this is an accident.
Hmm.
Correlation and causation are not the same, but if you don't get correlation, you certainly don't have causation. Right? So I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to get that powerful of a correlation between developing spiritual intelligence and then developing later stage capacities. And these later stages of adult development are related to, I think, what you're getting at, which is the ability to handle complexity and be able to be creative with your problem solving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you're talking to somebody in the business community about your work, how do you describe this in a way that you distinguish it from other types of approaches that somebody might be looking at bringing in and using in their workplace?
Right, that's a great question. What I have learned is that the most effective way to answer the question is to find out first what the problem is. You know, and so if I talk to a business leader and they're describing what the problem is, I am running a diagnostic in my head. Now remember, I've got 20 years of human resources training and, you know, sort of traditional organizational development tools available to me. I'm trained in integral theory, I'm trained in a whole lot of different models. So I don't come in with the spiritual intelligence will solve everything approach. I come in with a multiple intelligence and integral theory approach. And the four intelligences that I'm looking at these days, especially if I'm dealing with individual coaching, is physical intelligence, cognitive intelligence, emotional intelligence, and spiritual intelligence. And to me, depending on the job, we need a different mix of those intelligences.
Mm-hmm.
Physical intelligence, for most executives, you think, well, why would that matter? But energy is such a huge deal. People are exhausted, you know, and so if they don't get enough sleep, if they don't eat right, if they don't get any exercise and so on, they don't have energy, and their IQ, EQ, and SQ scores are all damaged. So I don't answer the question from any sort of generic. I find out, tell me what's your problem, tell me what's next for you, and I'll tell you what I think might be useful to help. Now, if I were to say the generic value of this for businesses is sort of my elevator speech, which if people say, like, why would I want SQ in business? I would say to them, question, do you have too much drama in your workplace? Now, I have not yet had anybody say to me, oh, gee, no, Cindy, actually, I was just thinking the other day, I'd really love to have some more drama and garbage going on in my workplace. And then I'll say, well, you know, what amount of time do you think is wasted on unnecessary drama in your workplace. Mm-hmm. And people will say anywhere from 10% to 30% is pretty normal.
Yeah.
The lowest I've had is 10%. So I said, if we could help you reduce the amount of drama in your workplace, that'd be a good thing. And they always say yes. How would you do that? And, of course, that's the essence of spiritual intelligence, is you're shifting out of ego motivations, which tend to be very high drama, victimizing, you know, stories, all that stuff, and moving over to higher self positions, which tend to not want to get engaged in all that drama triangle stuff. So that's the most generic answer I would give. But as a specific consulting engagement, I would always try to figure out what is the problem before I would recommend a specific solution.
Mm-hmm. So the big question, and maybe this is too big to answer, and it's maybe even asked with a little bit of tongue in cheek, but how might some of this have been useful in the banking industry 4 or 5 years ago before we entered
what
we're going on now?
Yes, really. The ability to do what the banking industry did requires some organizational failure as well as individual failures. So from an organizational standpoint, when you start losing line of sight between what you do and the impact of what you do, it kind of reminds me of those awful psychological experiments they used to do where they would have an actor in one room and a subject of the experiment in the other room. And the subject didn't know that it was an actor. They thought it was just a person in the next room. And they would instruct, a person in a lab coat would instruct the subject to deliver electric shocks to the actor, who would scream on cue, mm-hmm. right? And what they would notice, I think, is that the separation, because they couldn't see the person, they were more likely to deliver the shock. And then people who are of lower stage development are more likely to defer to authority. Mm-hmm. So I think we've got a couple of connections there to spiritual intelligence.
Yeah.
If you cannot see or feel the harm you're doing, you are much more likely to continue doing it. And if you are in earlier stage of development, who are more likely to just follow orders and not question them, you're more likely to get the ethical failures that
right.
we see. You know, where people, it's kind of like the Nazi German soldier arguing, I was just following orders.
Right.
So I think for each of us, the more we grow ourselves up and move into what Keegan, who's a wonderful researcher at Harvard, Robert Keegan, would call the self-authoring stage and beyond, we start being able to stand up for what we see needs to be defended. You know, like, this is wrong, and I will stand up and defy authority to say so. And that sort of, how do you see the other question, begins with empathy. I can feel your feelings. And moves into compassion, which is, I feel compelled to do something to relieve the suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if people in the banking industry had direct line of sight to the harm that they were going to do, I think it would have been a really good thing. So are we, as a culture, have we created such complexity in the banking system that you can't see the line of sight? And there are many experts in the field who said, you know, I had no idea these mortgage derivatives that I was selling were based on lies. So they had no line of sight. You know, they were selling garbage to their clients, not by intention. So I don't think there's a simple answer to this question, but one could say that if each person in the chain had been more emotionally and spiritually intelligent, would we have landed here? I don't think so.
Yeah. We've got another hand up, and we've got time for probably one quick question. This is someone whose phone number is ending 0942. So introduce yourself, and do you have a question?
Hi, Tom and Cindy. This is actually Judy Neal and Vivian Hill.
Oh, hi, Judy and Vivian.
Hey. Hi. Actually, a question for both of you. Since Tom does so much nature-based work, and work on vision questing, I'm wondering what the two of you see as the connection between things like going on a vision quest and the development of spiritual intelligence.
Hmm.
Tom, why don't you take it first?
The first thing that comes to my mind is that at its very basic, the vision quest is has the opportunity for a very extensive kind of retreat from the world. It almost becomes a meditative kind of process where
where the brain opens up to other levels of thinking. You start accessing parts of the brain and even the emotional body, I think, that you don't necessarily access in your day-to-day world. It's that liminal time and space that's created through the process. It's almost like what I find is that it starts helping people to drop, to first become aware of blind spots that they have in terms of their own relationships with others, with their work, with themselves, their histories. And it helps to start illuminating those blind spots and then helps people to start seeing them in a way that they haven't seen them before. And so people come out of the process with just a greater level of awareness and being in touch with things that they weren't even quite aware of in the past. Sometimes it triggers a lot more questions than it provides answers, which is, I think, part of that process of just constantly evolving and moving up the spiral, so to speak. So that would be my quick and short answer.
And my answer would be, while I don't have direct experience of vision questing, so I can't speak from personal experience, I do have experience of spending a lot of time in retreat and in prayer and meditation over certain questions. While it may not be as powerful in some regards in terms of symbolism and state experiences as perhaps what might occur with vision questing, I do think there are many ways to get in touch with our higher self, and it is the essence of spiritual intelligence that we start behaving from our higher self instead of from our ego self. And as we mature and move up the spiral, move up in stages of adult development, what we tend to find is that the ego becomes in service to the higher self instead of always being in sort of tug of war with higher self. And I think anything that helps us hear that voice of the higher self more clearly, put it more center stage in our life, is a really good thing. And I am aware that there is a potential trap in state experiences, which I always like to just kind of warn people about, in that you can get addicted to the meditative state experiences or the visionary state experiences and use that as a way of avoiding your life. And I don't think that's the goal of spiritual intelligence. So the goal is to behave with love, to show up, not to check out, but to use these tools as a means of hearing from your higher self and aligning with your higher self and developing over your life to be the most loving, effective person you can be.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Judy. One last question for you, Cindy. Where is your personal growing edge right now?
Oh, my never-ending growing edge. It seems to be around patience. And
That's a good one when you're working on a book.
Oh, well, and, you know, working on an assessment, I've been at this for 12 years now, you know, 11, 12 years, you know, creating it, going through the focus groups, going through Alpha Pilot, Beta Pilot, various levels of construct validation and cross-correlation. And, you know, it's like I want to do that, and I want to do my consulting work, and I want to write books, and. But my greatest source of impatience is often with myself, like how fast I can get things done. So I have to breathe and remember that the earth won't stop turning on its axis if I don't get this stuff done this year, and okay, do the best you can, you know, balance your life, all those things I would say if I were my own client. So I have to coach myself, and I have a therapist who kicks me in the butt when I need it too. So I think it's really important that we all have that. And to be patient with people who are not being compassionate and wise and don't appear to be interested in being compassionate and wise. So I feel that sort of judgment and contraction come up around people who I find to be most like I used to be. You know, isn't that kind of the thing? You know, so I see in them the arrogance I used to display so easily and calmly and that I have tried to overcome, and therefore I find it very annoying in others.
Well, we get an opportunity to teach that which we need to learn, right?
Oh, isn't that so true? Isn't that so true? And I often say that's how I got into this field, is that I wanted to learn how to be more like these people, the Dalai Lama, Jesus, Buddha, Lao Tzu, and so on. And so, you know, I'm my own greatest client in the sense that I built this so that I could become a better human being.
That's great. A couple of quick announcements, and then we'll come back for some final thoughts and wrap up. First, just once again, Cindy will be one of the featured speakers at the International Conference on Faith and Spirit at Work that's coming up November 7th through the 9th. It'll be held at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, and we're looking forward to that. We have a great lineup of speakers. Next month, on this teleconference series, we'll have another one of our speakers, Lynn Sedgemore. Lynn will be calling in from the United Kingdom, from Great Britain. She is a leader in the academic and business world and in government. And an organization that she was the executive director of a few years ago was a winner of the International Spirit at Work Award. So looking forward to having a conversation with Lynn on August 24th. If you'd like more information, you should go to our website, TFSW. And I'm going to have this wrong, tfsw.uark.edu, I believe is correct. And if there's a place there that you can sign up to receive our newsletter and announcements about upcoming events, we'd love to have you join in the conversation as we move forward. So just final closing thoughts. Cindy, it's been great to talk to you today. Anything else that you'd like to share before we sign off?
Oh, it's just a delight to support the Tyson Center and Judy's fantastic work that she's been doing for 15 or more years now, I think, Judy, on creating a more spiritual workplace. I'm really excited about the conference, and I know Lynn's call will be great. Lynn is a fantastic lady, I think. Very inspiring. Few people can be quite as inspiring, I think, as Lynn, so I hope everybody will tune in for that.
That's great. So I just want to leave everyone. Again, thank you, Cindy, and thank you to Judy and everyone at the Tyson Center for helping to make this these calls possible. This morning, as I was going through my my Facebook page quickly to see what everybody was doing, I found a quote from Pablo Picasso that just seemed to fit very nicely as a way to wrap up our call today. And Picasso said this, "If there were only one truth, you couldn't paint 100 canvases on the same theme." So with that thought, I just say thank you once again to everyone for joining us. Thank you to you, Cindy, and everyone just have a wonderful and blessed day. And we'll talk to you again on August 24th. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.